right out here on Long Island without, you know, any kind of miracle grow or anything, whatever. It's just regular soil. Yeah, I put in like 5 tomato plants, and I think I got 1 tomato on each one. So you're asking the wrong guy. Interesting thing I saw in Jeopardy, though, the other day. One of the questions, let me drop it. What has to do with how these certain plants, they named them, I forgot what they were called. They said that they track the sun across the sky, you know, so from, you know, from west to east, and they, the plant itself moves, you know, like a little parabolic dish, you know, it moves and follows the sun. And they said, you know, how does it do that? And the answer was circadian rhythm. So I'm going to investigate that. I have to figure out what kind of plant that was. I was interested in that, but I'm not a good farmer. I'm good at killing grass. Back you there.
I think it was Scott Kelly who was on the International Space Station for very close to 1 year, and his brother, is the twin brother, was down on Earth, not on the International Space Station. So after that year in space, I'm pretty sure they did quite a bit of comparison of bone density and general health. Have they released any results yet as to what the differences are between Scott and his brother? Back to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, Mark Kelly, also an astronaut, also a pilot, also became a commander. But he retired before Scott went up. And they did do tests on a regular basis, but I haven't heard any results. I know they made a big deal out of it before they went up. Dr. Sanjay Gupta from CNN, he was all fired up about this, but I haven't heard one. I guess I could search the internet and see what comes up, and anybody can write that. Usually I'd like to find it in a NASA story would be okay. That would be reliable. But yeah, they ran some tests on both guys. I don't think they're going to find that much of a difference. And Mark Kelly, he was the one that was married to Gabby Gifford, one that got shot out in Arizona, congresswoman. She survived. So, yeah, they ran a test, and I think they should have run the test with the other guy, too, even so he wasn't related, and see what kind of results came back on him, on a Russian. Mikhail Kortniego. I think they should compare the test with somebody that's not related. Back to you there.
Let's see if anyone else has any further questions for Paul and the Space Report. If so, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
This is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe, and I think you forgot to call me, Dick. Pretty sure I was on the list. Back to you.
I'm looking at my list. And for some crazy... Oh, yes. You're on the next line. Whoa. My goodness. Okay. We got to send you a gift. Go right ahead with your technical question or whatever, Joe. Sorry about that. KC2QIW. K2RIW in the second act.
Yay, Roger, Roger. Yay, we must have got mixed up with Joe number one over there. I guess quick, easy question. I should wait till next week, but it's okay. When should we change our 50-ohm coax cable? You know, like that runs outside. So you think we should change it like every 5 years or every 8 or 10 years? Over to you, Dick.
There's no problem. We don't have to rush on your technical question. Ask whatever you want to tonight at this time, Joe. Particularly because I skipped you. Coax per se doesn't wear out. Particularly hard line. Some of the 3/4 inch hard line I'm using, I'll bet you it's 25 years old. Let me think about that. If I go back 25 years from now, I'd be around 1980. No, 1990. Some of my hard line was installed in 1980. I've got a 30-year-old hard line on the tower, outdoors. As long as the connector is reasonably well weatherproof, water isn't getting into the cable, there is no real wear of hard line. In the case of flexible cable, I'm pretty sure the life is a hell of a lot shorter. You and I would like to believe the outer polyvinyl chloride jacket, the black jacket on the outside of a piece of flexible cable. You and I would like to believe that's a hermetic seal that keeps everything out of the cable. Let me drop it. To a person who builds space hardware, the outer jacket of flexible cable, they do not call that a hermetic seal. That is a weather seal. It keeps out the majority of the rain, but the water vapor does slowly migrate through that outer jacket and gets into the foam. In the case of what was considered a very high quality foam filled cable way back in 1970, it was ITT brand name, FM8 was the name of the stuff. It was about the same diameter as RG8, but it had a foam, a very low density foam cable, dielectric, a very thick center conductor. So it had a rather low loss when it was fully installed, when it was first installed. And I used a lot of FM8 on my array of 16 Yagis. When you look at that picture of that array of 16 Yagis on 432 that I'm standing in the middle of, the so-called red QSL picture, and you can see a copy of that picture by going to limarktechnet.com. Those cables that were the phasing harness on that antenna, let me drop. When that array antenna, after Hurricane Gloria was removed from my tower, I went and measured all of those 16 cables that were doing the phasing harness. Every single one of them had gone about 4 or 5 times higher in insertion loss than they were brand new, because of very slow water vapor infiltration through that outer jacket into the foam. I mean, if a couple of those cables had gone high in loss, insertion loss, and the others did not, I'd say, well, I did a bad job of inserting the connector on the end. Every one of them went up in loss about 5 times higher, the exact same amount. So I knew it was the failure of the cable itself. As such, I know I have to use flexible cable to go from my hard line going up the tower to the cable that goes around the rotator. And lots of people are very tempted to use foam-filled cable for the flexible cable because it's low in insertion loss. My philosophy on that is that the total amount of cable I use for the flexible link around the rotator is only a few feet long. The insertion loss is not what matters. Longevity is what matters. Let me drop. Question. Get to your question when I finish my statement. So as such, I make that flexible cable out of RG8 or RG9. RG9 is my favorite. RG9 is really a double shielded RG8. Because it has a solid polyethylene dielectric material, which is reasonably impervious to water, even though it has considerably higher loss than foam-filled cable, at least it doesn't have the ability for the foam to slowly suck up water. Water vapor is very lossy at frequencies like 432. Water makes a beautiful dummy load, so water vapor getting into your foam. So if it's a foam-filled cable with a flexible braid outer jacket, then I wouldn't trust it beyond, let me pick a number, 3, 4, 5 years. If it's a high VHF, UHF frequency, and you care about insertion loss. There probably are versions of foam-filled cable that are flexible, where the outer jacket is some kind of a foil. Let me drop it. Where the foil, either under the braid or outside the braid, where the foil makes a complete weather seal better than the outer plastic jacket. But the outer plastic jacket does slowly breathe water vapor. Our person with the question, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. When you know, started noticing, well, yeah, I guess you checked your search results after this assembly came down. Did anything previous to that time give you an indication that the performance was starting to drop low? And if you got an indication of such, did you measure the return loss of the entire antenna circuit and notice it to be a little different than when you initially installed it? Back to you.
Over the period of the 5 or so years that antenna was up, I am predicting the insertion loss slowly increased. I never saw any significant change in standing wave ratio. Occasionally the standing wave ratio would go up a little bit because water did get into one connector. And I could find that out real fast because I made sure that all the driven elements were insulated from the boom. As such, I could put an ohmmeter between center conductor and shield of the cable in the shack while all 16 antennas were connected. And if any one of them had water, I would see a change in resistance right away. The dry array of 16 antennas would measure quite a few megohms, center conductor to shield. As water got in there, it would start coming down between 200K and down to 100K, and if a whole lot of water got in there, it would go down to 50 kiloohms. So I knew right away when water was in any one of the connectors. So every so often I would find the connector with water in it and cure that problem. But the insertion loss slowly increased. I didn't know about it. I wasn't, if I was a real good guy doing moon bounce, then I wasn't. Let me drop it. Because I never got around to installing the elevation control, I never used it for moon bounce. I did a couple of moon bounce tests with the moon on the horizon, but I had no elevation control. If I had an elevation control, I would have been doing sun noise measurements every week or so, and I would have known the difference. But a rough guess is that I was getting a 3 or 4 dB of extra insertion loss. That's a lot of change in noise figure. 3 or 4 dB of increase in noise figure, as opposed to having a good preamp up there where you can get a couple of tenths of a dB noise figure. That makes a huge difference in sensitivity. But I wasn't measuring sun noise. I didn't know about it. So to me, it was pretty insidious. And I was doing all of those long-range QSOs with K4CAW, Greensboro, North Carolina, 432 sideband, every Tuesday for 4 years. 4.5 years on 432 sideband, and guarantee that those signals would have been a hell of a lot better to me if it wasn't for the insertion loss of the water vapor getting into that foam. And the water vapor in the foam made extra RF loss. It did not show up on an ohmmeter. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The extra insertion loss did not show up with a continuity test on ohmmeter. Okay, then if you think the water was being introduced into the cable itself, there was no connection between the outer jacket and the center conductor, even through the foam. If that's the case, how is the water impeding the signal going through it?
I'm pretty sure that ITT was claiming that the foam was a fully closed cell foam. So each one of the foam pockets in there was a closed cell. They were not connected to each other. But as water got into those foam cells, water as a dielectric material is extremely lossy. You would think that the water needs to make contact between the center conductor and the shield in order to create loss. Absolutely not. You and I can put a glass of water in a microwave oven. It's not connected to anything. There's no metallic structure anywhere. And that water will suck up all of that RF energy. A glass of water. Put a glass of water in your microwave oven with a Mr. Good Bar. And the Mr. Good Bar is sitting on a piece of low-density foam, not sitting on the glass at the bottom of your microwave oven. The Mr. Good Bar will run ice cold. The glass of water will boil. I particularly did that experiment because there's lots of stories saying that when Percy Spencer invented the microwave oven, he had been working at Raytheon. Let me drop it. On high-power Klystron tubes at S-band frequency, and the Mr. Good Bar in his pocket on a summer day melted. And he included the RF energy is what did it, and he went and invented the microwave oven. And he started cooking things like eggs and hot dogs and whatever. Well, I guarantee that the Mr. Goodbar in his pocket was melting because of the heat of his body. Mr. Goodbar contains no water. It runs ice cold in a microwave oven. And you have to do that experiment with a glass of water for a whole bunch of reasons. Without the glass of water, the microwaves are bouncing in the oven back and forth. They have nowhere to go. It's a high-Q structure. And you think you're putting 700 watts in there. The microwave, Mr. Goodbar may think it's seeing 70 kilowatts, if you know what I mean. And even if it's got a tiny bit of loss, you'll see some melting. And that's a phony test. With a glass of water, it becomes a real test. So water as a molecule sitting in a microwave oven is a lossy material. It doesn't have to be making contact to anything else. So the individual bubbles of water in the fully cell, closed cell foam creates the RF loss, but it will not show up on an ohmmeter per se. W-H-Y-Y-K-2-R-I-W, ain't that crazy?
Okay, it will not show up on a conductivity test across the cable. Will it show up at a return loss test, sweeping the antenna system across the frequency range of use?
Absolutely, and it'll give you a false alarm. You put a pair of 50-ohm terminations on a T-connector on the far end of a piece of cable, and the cable has extra loss. You expect to see a 3-to-1 visor, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, because you've put 25 ohms across the end of a 50-ohm cable. But because the insertion loss of the signal going down to the two terminations and coming back is experiencing extra insertion loss, you will see less return energy. Therefore, what should be a 2-to-1 visor will probably look like a 1.3-to-1, and you'll think you have a beautiful piece of cable. So extra insertion loss makes VisWire get better. They can really fool you. Over to you, Joe.
So say if you had those 50-ohm terminators, not at the end of a T, but at the end of a pair of cables attached to the T, and each piece of cable started having water migrate into it and get into the foam, into these little pockets, you're saying that would only add to the return loss of the circuit slightly, but the attenuation going through both tails would be a lot more dramatic. That's what you seem to be saying, to be correct?
No. If I have a single piece of cable 100 feet long, at the far end I got a T connector and a pair of 50-ohm terminations, 25-ohm load, 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. In the shack, I will measure something much lower than 2-to-1. I picked a number, 1.3-to-1, 1.5-to-1. I'll think it's a good piece of cable and not a very bad load. If the T connector was in the shack and I got a pair of 100-ohm cables going out there, I mean 100-foot-long cables going to two separate terminations, I'll measure the exact same number. It should, if the cables were lossless, I've got a pair of 50-ohm loads coming together at the T connector in the shack, I should see a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. In that particular case, what would I see? The cables themselves are 50 ohms. Yeah, in that case, I would see 2-to-1. Because of the impedance, each cable is now thoroughly matched. 50-ohm cable, 50-ohm load, even though it's lossy. So, with the T-connector in the shack and a pair of 100-ohm cables, I'll measure 2-to-1. With the T-connector at the far end of 100 feet of cable, I'll measure something a lot lower than 2-to-1. Over to you, Joe. W2RYY. Good question. K2RYW in the TechNet. A good puzzle question.
Well, maybe you get the wrong idea. I wasn't talking about measuring two cables from your shack. I was talking about measuring from one cable in your shack. And say the T-connector was connected to two pieces of RF cable, and each RF cable had a 50-ohm termination on it. Theoretically, you'd have a different impedance, half your impedance, even depending on where they are on the cable. It would change the phase of signals going back to the center of the cable. But if you had a little bit of water migration to those pieces of cable feeding the 50-ohm loads after the T-connector, you're saying that would only increase the return loss of the whole antenna circuit as you saw it overall, but the attenuation of the RF going through each cable would be much greater than originally was suspect. That's what I'm asking you. What, is that what you think?
The way you worded that had a huge number of ambiguities. You didn't tell me how far down range is the T-connector. I put the T-connector far end, and you're putting it some other place. I then went to the other extreme. I put the T-connector in the shack, and you said, no, that's the wrong place. You didn't tell me where the T-connector is going. You didn't tell me how long are the cables from the T-connector to the terminations. But the bottom line is all this. If any piece of cable anywhere has an improper termination so that there is supposed to be a reflected signal due to standing wave ratio, the signal going down to that mismatch is going to have insertion loss going down, a reflection from the standing wave ratio, and insertion loss of the reflected signal coming back. The reflected signal coming back, if the cable is improperly terminated, the reflected signal coming back will get a double attenuation down and back. Therefore, the apparent standing wave ratio will be lower. Is that a little more clear, Joe? To B2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Right, I do understand that. I was talking about if you had the T-connector at the end of a 100-foot piece of cable, and say if your two cables going off the T-connector were, let's say a half wavelength at the frequency that you're using, a half wavelength even considering the velocity factor, and you have 50 ohm loads at the end of each of those cables. If you had water migrating to each of those cables, it would only add a little bit of apparent return loss to the entire circuit of what you see, but overall you'd have much, much greater attenuation going through each one of those far-end short cables.
Okay, you've got a great puzzle number three. I've now got a lossless piece of cable going out in the yard to a T-connector. From the T-connector, I've got a pair of cables that are going to get some water absorption. Some length of cable from the T-connector, a pair of cables, going to terminations. The insertion loss of the cable will increase. The amount of power getting to the terminations will go down. The VIS-WR will be exactly 2-to-1 all the time. Why? Even though the cable's got water in and it's got extra loss, it's still a 50 ohm impedance. So you've got a 50 ohm impedance cable coming from the right side of the T-connector coming out, and from the left side of the T-connector, a 50 ohm piece of cable, both going to a 50 ohm termination. Each of those cables, although they've got extra loss, are the right impedance and the right termination. There is no VIS-WR in those cables. So from the center of the T-connector, because there's a pair of 50 ohm things, lossy cable with 50 ohm termination, at that point, you've got a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. If from that T-connector back to the shack, that cable is lossless, you will measure exactly a 2-to-1 VIS-WR. No matter what the insertion loss of the individual cables coming out of the T-connector is, the signals getting to the terminations are getting weaker, but the terminations are not making a reflected signal. Each termination is a 50-ohm load on a piece of lossy 50-ohm cable. No reflected signal coming back to the T-connector of the two outputs. You see what I'm saying on that one, Joe? W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet. A good third puzzle.
Well, I'm trying to. I'm trying to imagine that continuity-wise, DC-wise, the cable would measure approximately 25 ohms of resistance from the inside of the shaft, looking through the T-connector, through the other short piece of cable. Say they like part of your phasing harness going to your antennas. Instead of having antennas there, you put a 50 ohm termination on the end of those 50 ohm cables, which are in parallel with the T-connector going back to your main transmission line. And for what you're saying, that if you had a little bit of water migration in those far end right hand and left hand cables going off the center transmission line, that would add a great deal of assertion loss, but not necessarily make the entire return loss of the circuit look that bad.
The system would be a beautiful 50 ohm load, even though my 16 individual cables going to the 16 antennas has the phasing harness, and I'm simplifying it. There wasn't a 16-to-1 power divider. There were four separate 4-to-1 power dividers, but it doesn't matter. 16 individual cables going to the 16 antennas became very lossy, 5 times higher in loss. Made the signal going to the antennas a hell of a lot weaker. made the noise figure of the signal of the system a hell of a lot higher. Did not affect the VISWA. The antenna looked like a beautiful 50-ohm load, very similar to your puzzle number 3 with the T connector at the far end. Now you know why I had such trouble detecting it. My ohm meter from center conductor to shield said I didn't have water, per se. My insertion loss was in a place that did not affect the standing wave ratio. It only reflected the signal strength. How would you know the difference between the signal being weaker because the propagation over the 480-mile path wasn't as good today, as opposed to extra insertion loss of your 16 cables going to the 16 antennas? That's a very difficult thing to measure without measuring sun noise, which I was not doing. Very foolish on my part. Over to you, Joe, K2LAW.
So you theoretically, so you theoretically have to measure the sun noise first on a new installation and do it over a short period of time to get an average reading of the sun noise to know what your system is producing on your receiving apparatus. Then you could gauge that over months or years and say, okay, now it's degrading.
That's one way of doing it. A serious moonbounce guy does it a hell of a lot more scientific than that. He goes to the National Bureau of Standards. He finds out what is the solar flux number today, how much sun noise is coming out of the sun today. He knows the gain and the beamwidth of his antenna. He therefore knows how much sun noise the antenna should be getting if the antenna is working well. And he may go through that calculation, and the sun versus cold sky, maybe he's supposed to see 4.7 dB of sun noise compared to cold sky. And if he sees 3.7, he knows his system is 1 dB down from the performance it should have. Those guys have boiled it down to a science, Joe. Once they know the gain of the antenna and the solar flux number today, they know exactly what number they should measure. Over to you, Joe, K2LAW.
Okay, very, very good. This wasn't the question I was going to ask you after the end of the space report anyway, but it was just good to throw something in. I still have something else in mind.
Fire away.
Okay, this has been a curiosity question. I've been answered since the last week, the week before, but other things got in the way. Being that you say particles called photons help carry the transmission of energy in the frequency range of infrared, light, radio waves, and so forth, these particles help carry that energy from point to point. If that is true, then what is the highest wavelength they can actually, help convey from point to point? If the wavelength starts approaching the size of the photons, what happens?
And you're sort of asking, does electromagnetic energy, as you go to a high enough frequency, does it run out of steam? And everything I see says absolutely not. You and I could make a radio signal at 10 kilohertz and transmit it, and it would work beautifully. 16 kilohertz, in fact, somebody's super low VHF, HF, I don't know what are we doing, extremely low frequencies are used to communicate through seawater to a submarine up to 60 feet below the surface. So super low, no problem. Now, how high can you go? I mean, you and I, we think 432 is a pretty high frequency. I thought it was really up there. I was going to get a nosebleed when it was on 10 gigahertz. My buddy down in Virginia, I can't think of his call letters right now, he operates ham radio on 420 gigahertz. There are guys doing work at 3 terahertz. Far infrared, near infrared, medium infrared, optical, ultraviolet, extreme ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray. You go higher and higher in frequency, those photons keep transmitting that signal. I see no evidence they run out of steam. The amount of noise, let me drop it. The amount of random noise you get when you turn off the signal and you got a good receiver at these crazy frequencies, the amount of random noise changes by some pretty funny phenomena. I can't think of the exact word to use for it right now. But the random noise does change. But the signal itself doesn't run out of steam. The wavelength of gamma rays is very small compared to the molecules of the copper that they're flowing through, so to speak. One of the experiments I did on 10 gigahertz, this is a thought experiment, the weakest signal I could hear on 10 gigahertz with my 1 dB noise figure front end, listening in the CW mode, where my hearing goes down to 100 hertz of noise equivalent bandwidth, I can hear a signal of something like minus 150 dBm, a weak signal at 10 gigahertz. Okay? If that signal is coming in on, let me pick a number, a dipole antenna, I know the strength of the signal, I know the impedance of the antenna, 70 ohms, I know exactly what voltage is on the antenna. In order for that, I know how much current is flowing. In order for that amount of current to flow for one cycle at 10 gigahertz, which is 100 picoseconds per cycle, 50 picoseconds per half cycle. In those 50 picoseconds, for 50 picoseconds, the electrons are flowing out on the right-hand side of the dipole. For 50 picoseconds, the current is flowing back to the left on the right-hand side of the dipole. And I know the signal strength, I know the microamperes and picoamperes. I calculate at the speed of light for that brief period of time, for that very small signal, how far do those electrons move? And the answer is a very, very small fraction.
Repeater, timeout.
Right at the good word. A very small fraction of the diameter of a proton or the diameter of an electron. When the electron that's doing the current movement on the dipole that gives me the signal that I'm hearing moves that small a fraction of the diameter of a proton or the fraction of the diameter of an electron. Is that real? Answer is absolutely yes. There's a million electrons involved. The total number of electrons on that dipole is a huge number. But the amount of motion that those electrons have to have to give me that signal, the amount of physical distance they move is so small, it's hard to believe. And that's at 10 gig. Can you imagine if I did it at a million times higher? You and I know what 640 megahertz is. The optical wavelength that your eyes are operating at right now is 1 million times higher in frequency. The X-rays and gamma rays are 1 million times higher than that. As you go higher in frequency, there's less time for the electrons to move on each half cycle, therefore they move less distance. And if their distance on a weak signal is a small fraction of an electron's diameter, is that real movement? Is that a real signal? The answer is yes. It doesn't run out of steam. Ain't that crazy, Joe? To be 2LYY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, I was talking about after the signal leaves the antenna. You said not one electron leaves the antenna. The conduction of the field is being conducted by, I believe what you said is photons are carrying the energy from point to point. That's what I was getting at. Not electrons within the antenna, but after it leaves the antenna or the emitting source.
Absolutely.
And repeater, timeout.
And you and I can now talk about how much energy is in each one of those photons to transport that extremely weak signal through a vacuum. And the amount of energy is a number so small, it's hard to believe. So, not a single electron leaves the antenna. It is my belief a magnetic field leaves the antenna. The modern day teachers will tell you it's an electromagnetic field leaving the antenna. They think there's an E field and an H field. I'm having trouble believing there's an E field, but that's a minor detail. But the signal going through the air, is it a wave or is it particle? The answer is yes. There are certain ways you can run the experiment and you'll think that those photons are particles. There are certain ways you can run the experiment and you'll think those photons are waves. It's a wave-particle thing, but they are photons. So photons are flowing through the vacuum of space. They convey energy. And when you get to these super weak signals, the amount of energy per photon is a number so small, it's scary. But it doesn't run out of steam. No matter how small it is, it's a calculatable number, and it does it. No matter what frequency you're at, no matter what energy you're at, it does it. No matter how weak the signal is it above Can you detect it? The only thing to answer is, what's the sensitivity of the instrumentation you use to measure that signal? The signal never goes to zero, no matter how many zillions of miles you are away from it. Use the right material, use the right radio telescope, and you will hear that signal from a zillion miles away. The radio telescopes are doing it every day. Over to you, Joe, K2LAW.
Okay. I guess maybe you missed the point there. I was talking about with the wavelength it's trying to convey from point to point. If that wavelength approaches the size of a photon, and it's going to be an extremely small wavelength, extremely high frequency, possibly, I haven't looked enough, so I don't know the sizes offhand right now. You would probably know that more than I would. I'm talking about frequencies higher than cosmic rays, whatever that frequency range happens to be. In fact, we detect things in the range of cosmic rays. Is there anything past cosmic rays as far as things that we've detected, or we don't have anything available to be able to detect frequencies past cosmic rays? Back to you.
Everything I read and everything I hear tells me, Joe, that the electromagnetic radio spectrum, I should call it electromagnetic spectrum, we call it DC to light, DC to X-ray, DC to gamma rays, DC to cosmic rays. It doesn't run out of steam. There is no end to it. Is there a frequency you go to so high where you can't go any higher? The answer seems to be no. If you use the right instrumentation, you can always go higher. And you said the size of a photon. I think you could talk about the energy of a photon. It's not a physical object. I don't think you can call it a size. It's a wave particle-like thing. It has, depending on what frequency you're working at and what the dielectric constant of your medium is, it has a predictable wave length. And is that the size of the photon? I don't think so. The wave that's being conveyed has a wave length. You can envision it as a piece of wire in space that's got a wave moving along the wire, and the positive deflection and negative deflection of the wire represents positive and negative signal polarity. Let me drop this. That's the wavelength. But the photons that are conveying that energy, I'm not sure they've got a size, Joe, but they don't run out of steam. No matter what frequency you want to envision, I guarantee you can go higher in frequency, Joe. There's no end to it. At least there's no... Just like there's no end to space, I think there's no end to the frequency spectrum. Back to you, Joe.
The B2LAW. So what you're saying, it seems to be that the size of these photons, or these particles, you're calling photons, is not measurable, or it is measurable. I'm a little confused on that.
The photons, are they particles or are they waves? And the answer is yes and yes, depending on how you do the experiment. They have properties of both. They're conveying the energy of your particular wavelength. I'm not sure you can say the photons have a size. You're about to ask me, what the hell is a photon? It's something that conveys electromagnetic energy. And the electromagnetic energy that you and I are using has a particular frequency. Therefore, it has a predictable wavelength, knowing the speed of light. But I don't think you can talk about the size of a photon. We can talk about the energy of photons. It's not a physical object. It doesn't sit still. It's only there if it's moving at the speed of light, is my understanding. Speed of light of that particular medium. I don't think it has a size, Joe. But I'm on shaky ground on this one. Over to you, Joe. K2LAW.
Okay, that's what I was asking. Why I was asking this question, because it just made me a little curious. If the wavelength it was trying to help convey, however you want to call it, if that wavelength approaches the size of the photon, what would happen? And you're saying this, it's something that you can't measure, so it's got to be something extremely small. Obviously, we know they exist, so we have ways of detecting them. If we have ways of detecting them, we don't have ways of measuring their actual, physical properties, if they have physical properties or not.
Intuition.
Yeah, you're thinking, Joe, that you can't go beyond the size of the photon. By the same token, I would say, at a high enough frequency, I can't go beyond the weakness of signal where the electrons conveying the current through my dipole, for instance, are moving less than the diameter of an electron. There's no limitation there. I can make the signal weak enough so that the electrons on the dipole are going to move 1/100th the diameter of an electron. That's still a real signal. And the weakness of the signal that I can measure with my 10 gig equipment doesn't come close to the weakness of signals that these guys with a good radio telescope can measure. They can measure something 30 dB weaker than that with various synchronous detection and integration techniques and other kinds of Reed-Solomon techniques and whatever. So is there a limit to how weak a signal can be and be measured? The answer seems to be no. Is there a limit to how small the wavelength can be and still convey electromagnetic energy? I think the answer is no. And in all of this, the size of the electron on the dipole doesn't matter. The size of the photon in free space, I think, doesn't matter, even if you could measure it. N2XJN, K2RIW, Wes is going to clear this all up for us because I don't know what the hell's going on here. You got it, Wes.
I'd like to have Dr. Roy as well here, if she's listening. Well, if you look at wave-particle duality, then we would say it electron could behave as a photon. So now we could compare the quantum parameters of the photon to the electron. However, photon doesn't exist. Photon is something that we invented for us, ourselves, just to be able to explain something. Now, if we think about how we can express photon, well, we can express photon with the wavelength. Nobody does it any longer. We express photon mostly with electron volts or kilo electron volts. But we could express electromagnetic wave in any wavelength, also in some of electron volts. In other words, mass of an electron is zero. Mean light type is stable. The electric charge of photon is zero. That's why when photons travel through the space, they're not able to couple, bounce on each other, they don't see each other. They're not able to, they're able to cross each other, they're not able to manifest their presence at all, unless they hit a mass. So in order for us to still see, measure, or in any way find the energy of the photon, we need to hit the mass. That's the part of it. Now I have a question for you. Well, you say that we could have a communication through gammas and x-rays and ultraviolet. I agree with you. However, the greater the frequency range of the transmission medium, the greater the number of the beats per second it can transmit. So, in other words, the bigger the bandwidth in hertz available, the bigger the bandwidth in beats per second can be transmitted. Is it that we don't use, because I don't believe we use, x-rays and gamma rays for the communication because of the technical issues? Let me go. My question regards gamma rays, x-rays, ultraviolet, and do we still need to use the fiber optic in order for us to be able to transmit? Back to you.
As you go up the frequency spectrum, more bandwidth is available. Therefore, you can transmit more bits per second through that bandwidth. Fiber optic systems with multiple wavelengths going down them are giving you tremendous bandwidth rates, 50 gigabits per second type stuff is, I think, becoming common these days. So maybe even terabits. So the higher the frequency, the more bandwidth is available. And whatever your bit data rate is, that tells you the bandwidth the signal is likely to occupy with the usual methods of modulation. And down at 10 megacycles, you don't have anywhere near enough bandwidth to send a 50 gigahertz signal. up at 100 gigahertz, you could do that. So the fifth generation and all of our other advanced programs are going to higher and higher frequencies because that's where the available bandwidth exists. Now, you said the electron has no charge. I disagree with that. It's something like 10 to the minus 19 coulomb.
No, no, it says photon doesn't have a charge. Photon doesn't have a charge. Electron has minus.
Okay. You use the words electron has no charge and electron has no mass.
No, no, I said we have electron duality, particle duality. So we may say that electron could behave as a photon, it could behave as an electron. So it could behave as a particle, it could behave as a wave. And that's given. But if it behaves as a wave, then it doesn't have a charge. It does have a wavelength. Enter it here.
AC2GS here.
Go ahead, that's a race.
Hey, we need you, Roy. Roy, what's the size of a photon? Over to you, Roy.
Photons are sizeless. They're dimensionless, singular points in space. They don't have dimensions. They don't have width. They don't have diameters. I'm sorry, but they don't. Electrons don't either. Electrons do have weight. They do have charge. Electrons and protons and neutrons have a degree of wave-particle duality, but they don't lose their physical constants even in that wave-particle duality.
WS2N.
Now, not a single electron leaves my antenna when I'm transmitting. Energy is going into space. For lack of better words, we say that photons. What's going into space that's conveying the energy? We call it an electromagnetic wave. But there's not a single electron out there, so how is a charge being made? A magnetic field, I can accept that. And so give us any words you can to make us feel a little bit warmer as to how electrons moving back and forth on my dipole antenna create an electromagnetic wave that consists of essentially no mass, no easily recognizable charge by my standards, and yet that energy conveys through space. Over to you on that one, Roy, and then pass it over to Paul. AC2GS, K2RAW in the group.
AC2GS, you always give me the easy questions to answer. I tend to still believe that moving the electrons around in your antenna induces an electric field, which then induces a magnetic field around that area, and the two electric and magnetic fields interact until they become synchronized, which is the only way that they can propagate. Otherwise, they dissipate to the cube or the fourth or the fifth power of their distance. I know it's difficult, and I know you sort of don't believe or agree with me on that, but that's what I think is going on.
Okay, you had a question, Paul. WS2N? Hopefully you're going to straighten this all out, Paul. K2RAW in the group.
You saw, I found a good website that says that the size of the photon is whatever the wavelength is. So you might have a real teeny tiny one, like you were saying before, or you might have a larger one. You know, it might be as big as 10 or 12 centimeters. It just depends on the wavelength. Just one of those things. Back to you, Nick.
Well, will particle duality stands in quantum mechanics about exhibiting properties of both waves and particles. So I'm a little bit confused with explanation of the two rows. Single photon may be refracted. But then, it is acting as the wave. Back to you, Dr. Rowe.
Well, as I said before, photons and electromagnetic waves possess wave-particle duality. You can't really describe a photon as the wavelength of the wave because the photon is the particle aspect of this phenomenon. So it wouldn't quite make sense. So what happens is you have arguments in semantics rather than physics.
Now, let me give you my explanation on... I've given you once before, but I'm going to say it once again because this group is a little bit different, and maybe you'll have a different explanation. Let me drop. If I'm doing a laboratory experiment, And I've watched this happen many times at both Airborne Instruments Laboratory, at Symbol Technology. I've watched it filter spelled backwards, Red Lab. I've watched measurements made that are traceable to the Bureau, where they wanted to be sure that this particular instrument, that's called a handheld appliance, must be able to survive 100 volts per meter of electromagnetic wave without failure. And they put it inside of a GTEM machine to make that measurement. The GTEM machine is a very large feed horn-like device, except that it has one extra piece of sheet metal in that feed horn, a septum that goes down the center. They put, by way of the type N connector at one end of this horn, at the narrow end, they put a known amount of signal. Maybe it's a 1 watt signal, maybe it's at 1 gigahertz, because that's where you're making the measurement at this instant. You put a known amount of signal between that upper sheet of metal and the lower sheet of metal. You put your device on the test in between those sheets of metal. And by a calculation and measurement and procedure, you establish a signal of 100 volts per meter that your device on the test is going to be measured in the X, Y, and Z plane. So you have an upper sheet of metal, a lower sheet of metal, and real signal, real electrons you put onto that sheet of metal, and that generates a calibrated, traceable to the Bureau, 100 volts per meter. In free space, there is no upper sheet of metal, there is no lower sheet of metal, and there were no electrons put on the sheet of metal if it was there. And yet we're telling each other that you give me a strong enough radio signal in free space, I still have 100 volts per meter.
Repeater, timeout.
You didn't use the usual raw ingredients to create that 100 volts per meter, and yet it's there. Why do they bother using a GTEM machine if I can generate that free space signal without the GTEM? AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The problem is that energy carriers don't manifest the energy that they carry. So electromagnetic waves or photons don't possess an electrical charge per se, or a net zero electrical charge and a magnetic moment. The same way that a graviton, although it might be theoretical, doesn't possess any gravitational forces on it. So that's a problem. I think the best way to think of it is the photon doesn't have the electric potential. It induces an electric potential. It has the potential to induce that. But you need a solid medium to have that induction occur.
I think I'm agreeing with you. Now, if I go to my crazy theory that what we call an electromagnetic wave, and we think it's got an E field and an H field at right angles to each other, I am speculating that it might be nothing but a magnetic field. But when that varying magnetic field encounters the wire of my dipole, by Maxwell's equation, the rate of change of the magnetic field induces a known voltage, similar to what happens in the secondary winding of a 60-cycle transformer. But this is operating at 1 gigahertz, we'll say. So by Maxwell's law, if I get the right law, the rate of change of magnetic field induces a voltage. Therefore, we think the voltage was in free space. By all the measurements we make, it appears that there's a voltage in free space. I can propose an experiment where I could confirm whether or not the voltage really was there in free space ahead of time. Someday I'm going to run that experiment. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2LAW.
About as close as we two have gotten together on this theory. Now, my problem is the sole magnetic field. I don't see how you can prove that a sole magnetic field propagates. The whole point of an electromagnetic wave is it propagates in free space infinitely forever and ever. And, you know, I mean, we've talked about quadrature delayed electromagnetic waves. They do exist around transformers, but they don't propagate, and that's why you don't see that type of a wave phenomena. But it would be interesting if you could come up with an experiment using purely magnetic waves and calculate the propagation of those magnetic waves without an electric component.
Yeah, bye.
In the previous transmission, all the times that I said the word Maxwell, I should have said Faraday. By Faraday's law, the rate of change of magnetic fields is creating a voltage into that conductor that's subjected to that changing magnetic field. Okay, here's a experiment. I've got an ordinary 60-cycle, one-to-one isolation transformer. I got 120 volts going into the primary. My magnetic field coupling, the secondary, has 120 volts, one-to-one turns ratio. I could, if I raise the frequency high enough, eliminate the magnetic core and still keep the thing running. I might have to run it at 1 megacycle instead of 60 hertz. But by raising the frequency, because I didn't have enough inductance without the magnetic field, without the magnetic material, I eliminate the magnetic material. So I'm now putting 1 megacycle into the primary, and with the right kind of winding of the secondary, the transformer will continue to work. I now start separating the secondary winding from the primary winding. I know the magnetic field getting to the secondary winding is going to get smaller. It's going to fall off by a kind of an inverse square law. So as I separate the secondary winding further and further in distance, it continues to pick up a signal, but a weaker and weaker signal. And if I'm smart enough to resonate that secondary winding, similar to what I would do with a dipole, I can now drastically increase its sensitivity. So I've now got a Faraday cage around the primary winding so that no E field is being transmitted by the primary winding. Let me drop. This 1 megacycle, 100 megacycle magnetic field coming off the primary winding is picked up by the secondary winding, which is resonated at that frequency. And I keep separating the distance between the two. I am getting a purely magnetic wave transmitted from that primary to that secondary. Where in that experiment did I suddenly flip over from magnetic coupling into a TEM wave coupling? If my receiver on that secondary winding is sensitive enough, I'm pretty sure I could separate that a mile and still pick up that signal. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2LAW.
And I have a comment.
As far as Faraday, Faraday is one of the equations of Maxwell's equations, too. So you can call it Maxwell's or Faraday's, you know. That's an interesting experiment, and I've heard you mention it before. One of the many things is I would wonder how the signal fell off. I would think that if it would be purely a magnetic phenomena, it would fall off of 1 over R cubed instead of 1 over R squared. Because that's the way magnetic fields are supposed to work, because of the fact that there's no such thing as a monopole for magnets, so it's R cubed. So that would be the same as an electromagnetic wave, which is R squared, right?
Yes, the magnetic field is falling off by R squared when it comes to a TEM wave. However, the TEM wave is not... There are lots of people who think the TEM wave is trading magnetic energy into electrostatic energy, and electrostatic energy back into magnetic energy, that they're flowing back and forth. That is not supportable, because the peak of the E field in free space and the peak of the H field in free space are the exact same instant of time, the exact same position in space. So the rate of change of magnetic field is zero, and that's at the time when the E field is also maximum. So the TEM wave seems to be violating Faraday's law. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2LAW.
KC2QIQ with some important information about transformers.
Want to have Glenn say his thing?
I know what's going to happen. An additional factor is going to be added, and we're not going to get anywhere. But go ahead, Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Well, your question before was, what is the difference between the transformer and the TEM wave? The difference between the transformer is the path length alignment of the field. If you look at the wave when a core fits inside a transformer, the path length is fixed. So if you have current in the primary winding, its relationship in primary to in secondary is always perfect. But the voltage can vary due to coupling. So in other words, if the windings aren't properly aligned, the voltage will drop.